My Swedish friend, what are you hoping for from tonight's gig?
Just Roy Harper and great music.
Anything you want. Yeah. Anything he cares
I'm
to play.
And just see Roy.
Good answer. El Rose, what are you hoping for from tonight's gig?
I'm hoping that it won't ruin the marvellous memories I have of seeing him at the Jazz Cafe, actually.
Sorry I couldn't come last night. I hope you apologise to Nick for me.
Are you on the way somewhere or can I quickly have a voice?
Yes.
What are you hoping for from tonight's concert?
I'm actually hoping to cry. I'm hoping to have a tear fill the eye. I don't care whether it's Roy on his own or with lots of other people, but already it's been just so good meeting everybody here from the Stormcock site. And really having just absolutely wonderful time.
Great.
Today, doesn't it?
Good answer, Steve.
Thank you for asking.
All right. Might as well have you as well. James?
In the other game, either.
Why are you here and what are you hoping for?
Something vocal.
You want something vocal?
Yeah, he was looking confused.
To listen to some good music, to enjoy myself, and to get home in one piece.
Okay. Good answer. Good answer. I've got to talk to that guy over there because I've known him for ages and I've never actually met him.
I'm not going to get up.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to meet you at last.
Thank you for all the hard work.
Do you mind saying something quickly? I'm asking everybody what they're hoping for from the concert. Hoping for from the concert.
I'm hoping
for. Oh yeah.
I'm hoping for a branding thing that no one shouts out white man.
They will.
This is Paul, who's our leader.
Hello, pleased to meet you.
The leader, wow.
Well, so they say.
What are you doing?
I just want to ask you what you're hoping for from tonight's gig.
Well, obviously, I'm hoping for nobody's got any summer in the money in the summer.
And it's a very apposite song for these interesting times in which we live. Very good. Thank you.
Is this for the podcast?
Yeah. Anything else you want to say?
Nick playing with Roy. Nick playing with Roy is amazing.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get that. Okay, that's it. Hello, Simon Foster.
Hello, Paul.
What are you hoping for tonight's gig? For from tonight's gig? He's holding his hands in the air.
I don't know.
John Barker.
I don't know.
Anything that Roy cares to do is the answer you're looking for.
Anything that Roy cares to do.
Okay, thank you.
It's fine by me.
Your wife says I have to come round and drink beer. I can do that.
Mr. Bailey.
Good evening.
What are you hoping for tonight?
A shag.
That's not a bad idea, is it?
From Roy.
Well, I don't want to shag off Roy, do you?
No. I have not bothered to give it any thought whatsoever. I want him to not cock it up, that's what I want him.
That's good enough. So, Simon, what are you hoping for from the gig?
Whatever Roy wants, it's fine by me.
Hello and welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is number 36, published December 2011. This will be the last podcast in 2011, so can I wish you all in advance a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Now, this is a special show looking back at the gig at the Royal Festival Hall, London, November the 5th, 2011. I'm not actually going to be talking too much this episode, as there's an awful lot to pack in. We've got two interviews this time, firstly with Dave Cochran, and secondly with Mr. Roy Harper. Now, talking about the Royal Festival Hall, well, what a gig. I'm not going to go on about it too much in this preamble, except to say it was one of the most fantastic nights out I've ever had. I just loved it. I will give you a quick set list. It started with Highway Blues, then Frozen Moment, North Country, I'll See You Again, Me and My Woman, which is when Nick Harper arrived, Hallucinating Light with Nick Harper again, Commune, 12 Hours of Sunset, an abbreviated White Man, Another Day with Joanna Newsom on vocals, Cricketer, Same Old Rock with Jimmy Page, Green Man. And at various stages throughout the evening, a bunch of players playing strings and brass also accompanied Roy, called the Bedford Players, I believe, in memory of David Bedford. So let's launch into our first interview.
Are you alright on that still?
I'm good.
Alright, so it's 4:11 in the afternoon on Saturday the 5th of November, and I'm in a slightly noisy cafe with Mr. David Cochrane. Hi Dave. Now, long-term listeners will know that we interviewed Dave, and I can't believe this, because it was in July 2008, and it feels like just yesterday.
I thought it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, me too. It's quite weird. Some of you won't have heard the interview with Dave, and if you haven't, you should go through the archives and have a listen, because we had a good time. But Dave, give us a quick intro for people that haven't heard your previous missive.
Where do I start?
At the beginning.
I came to England in 1974 to play with a band called The Sharks, which was with Chris Petting on guitar. Chris introduced me to Roy Harper at the same time we recorded Motorbiking.
Right.
During that same early 75.
Uh-huh.
And we started HQ with Roy at Abbey Road. And that began a lifetime friendship with Roy.
And that was 75?
75.
Yeah.
Seems like forever.
Well, it's a fair time to go. Yeah. But it is one of the seminal albums. I mean, everybody loves that album. So.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, naturally.
Well, you would be. I'd be surprised if you didn't.
I did others, you know, two or three others after that.
Because that was Trigger, wasn't it?
That was Trigger.
And then it morphed into Black Sheep, was that?
It went to Chips.
Chips, of course,
and
Chips.
And then I think Black Sheep was the kind of last thing.
Yeah. So that lasted. What was the last album that you did? Because there was
Commercial
Breaks was the one that wasn't released for a long time,
yeah,
wasn't it? Because AMI started getting, and it all went a bit weird.
That was the last one.
And that came out eventually.
Yeah.
Like, you know, 10 years ago or whatever.
Did that have, I can't remember, did that have square boxes?
Yes,
Yeah.
I Want to Be Part of the News,
yeah.
Cora.
Cora's a good
original
song.
Flycatcher.
Yeah.
Which is great, actually, because that resurfaced on Unknown Soldier.
Yeah.
Get my anorak on here. So, happy years. And you did some live stuff with him as well, obviously.
Touring. For years and years. We toured. Well, we did a major English tour after the HQ record. Then, when that kind of fell apart, I was living in Memphis then.
Right.
I went back home to Memphis, and I was just sitting there one day, and phone rings. I pick up the phone. He said, "Hey, it's Roy." I said, "Oh, cool. And how are you?" He said, "I'm in Memphis. Come get me."
Really?
Yeah. I said, "Okay, I'm on my way." You
know? Right.
So, went and picked him up, and then he and I moved out to LA for the rest of the year.
Oh, nice.
Just stayed out there. We brought some guys that eventually was the Black Sheep guys. Andy and John Halsey.
Yeah.
Dave Lawson didn't come out to LA.
So what were you getting up to in LA then?
Huh?
What were you getting up to in LA?
We did an American tour.
Right.
And we toured with Tommy Bowen.
Right.
You know, it used to be Deep Purple and all that.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that band kind of, it wasn't working out at the time, and we got some American friends of mine, and that was even worse, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But anyway, we did the tour. In 77, we came back here, and then we started with Henry McCullough and what turned into Black Sheep.
Right.
And Chips.
Yes.
We changed the name of the band so everybody think, oh, he's got something new going on.
But it was the same old people.
Oh, well, yeah. You got to book it since it's a new band.
Well, yeah, no, that's it. So, I mean, I spoke to you 3 years ago. At the time, you're still involved in music, and we talked a bit about some stuff, some tracks you've been working on.
Yeah.
I know you also do a day job, or a night job, I should say.
Still doing it.
That place you sometimes go at night.
That's the place I sometimes go at night.
Yeah,
a lot of nights.
So, I mean, that's great. I mean, what's changed in the last 3 years?
I'm still going to that place I sometimes go at night. I've got two projects coming up in L.A., hopefully before the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really want to say what they are because I don't want to jinx myself.
No, 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 that's
and
fine.
And it's a secret from her. She has a place she sometimes, Sarah does, sometimes goes at night. My sweet friend from up there, I'm not going to disclose where she's from.
Okay. Cool's in trouble now.
I'll be in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, and trying to do these projects, I got a personal project I'm working on, and I've been writing a book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
what's it about? Life story?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll buy a copy.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
So, when's that going to come out?
And when I finish it. But what I'm trying to do is coordinate the music project I'm doing. The guy, one of the guys that's kind of investing in it, he wants to do a CD and kind of an interview, DVD compilation, and judging on what kind of reaction we get from that, to follow that up with the book.
I tell you what, there'll be a lot of people wanting to get that.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. No, that sounds maybe great. I mean, I love reading that kind of book because it brings you to the moment. I mean, what's the guy from Which Seasons Productions, late 60s? Something Boyd, I can't remember what his name is. Guy was around with Fleet Foxes convention and Nick Drake and everything like that.
Yeah,
and I read his book, and it transports you back there. And reading it from the inside, and what people, you know. Although if you remember it all, then you, you know.
did you read the book about Andrew?
I haven't actually.
I was in all of that.
We saw the
film. Not in the book, but I was during that time.
Right.
I
yeah.
Used to teach Andrew's one of his girlfriends how to play bass.
Oh, really? Have you seen the movie, the one with Andy Serkis in it?
Mm-hmm.
It's quite good. Vicky and I saw it. It's well, it's somebody impersonating him, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But he does a really good job, from what I can see, of the whole mannerisms and everything. And he doesn't pull any punches as well.
Cool.
You know, because he had his moments of being, you know, a bit of a...
Yeah. You're being nice.
And that comes... I'm English, of course, sometimes. You know. but no, the book sounds absolutely... You know, when you have more info, let us know, because, you know, people will be really interested.
I think Will Birch wrote it. And,
yeah.
He doesn't pull any punches either. I mean, it's pretty dead on to what my memory.
Cool.
I mean, I never had any problems with him, and we had the same management. Actually, Roy had the same management. It was Peter Jenner.
Peter Jenner, yeah.
At Black Hill. And then in the same office underneath was Stiff Records.
Yeah.
So it all worked out, and I got to know all those Stiff guys.
Interesting times.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
I mean, music was really exciting at that point. Everything was seemed. You felt like there was a big change, and you know, a lot of energy, which I don't think necessarily is here at the moment. But you know.
Also, at the time, my next door neighbor was Rat Scabies.
Oh, really?
Played drums in the band. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Great guy. Great guy.
Oh, all right. So, what brings you to London?
Now?
Yeah.
Her and tonight Roy Harper concert, naturally.
Yeah,
I wouldn't miss
course.
This for the world.
No, I mean, it's everybody listening will know, but I mean, I've been droning on about this for the last 6 months. This is the 70th birthday celebration, so we're all very excited because you don't get to see the old boys so much these days.
I missed the 60, so there's no way I was going
to. Well, I'll tell you, I was here for the 60th as well, but again, going back to the how time flies past, it feels to me like about 5 years, not 10 years.
Yeah.
You know.
Was that Albert Hall?
No, the festival was the same place.
It was?
Hall. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Although that 10 years ago, he had loads and loads of guest stars.
He told me that he kind of felt like he's on a roller coaster for that one.
It did feel a bit like that. You know, a revolving stage almost, with more people coming in and leaving and so on.
Yeah.
But he had people like John Renbourn playing with him, and that, you know, that was great from our point of view. But it must have been a hell of a strain from his point of view. I mean, just shuffling in and out. Because I think there's a lot of people that are, you know, expecting the reformation of Led Zeppelin tonight and all kinds of weird stuff going on.
I don't think that's
not going to happen.
No.
But. At the Nick Harper gig last night, Nick did announce that he was working this evening, even though it wasn't on his website, but he'd be working selling the programmes in the foyer. So.
Okay.
But no, I mean, you know, the odd tune from Nick with Roy would be great, because yeah. I saw Nick and Roy play together a lot in the 90s, particularly when Nick was coming up as a, you know, new guitarist and hadn't really been doing a lot of solo gigs at that point.
I haven't seen Nick since he's a little bitty.
Really?
Kid, yeah.
No, he's grown up a bit.
Oh yeah, I can't wait to see him again.
Yeah, no, I mean, we all love his music. He's got an amazing guitar.
He's got a good start. So, like
yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. Now, interestingly enough, before we started recording, I asked you, did you ever... There's a few CDs out with you playing on them, and there's some BBC sessions.
I don't have copies.
And you don't have copies, so we're going to have to rectify that.
I need a copy. I need a copy of the BBC tapes.
Yeah, well, you need to have, you know, the record of the stuff that you did.
Yeah.
But I suppose everybody would be asking whether you've got any secret recordings at home.
I may.
You may. You're not prepared to comment.
I'll have to look, because I got so many.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still on cassette.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I got something. Because I used to record rehearsals.
Right.
Like when we were at Rockfield.
Yeah.
When we were recording down there. Did I tell you the story about what happened down there?
No, go ahead.
Oh, Jesus. So we go in, and it's a great old, like, house. And... there's a rehearsal studio in the house.
Yeah.
And then down the road a piece is Rockfield Studio. So everybody gets in, it's, you know, we want to get settled in, and they take me upstairs and show me this room that I'm going to be staying in. I said, man, this is such a foul smell. Something really stinks. I mean, it's horrible. So I break out some incense and start burning incense and all that. Go down, we have the dinner, and you know, go over a few songs. I go back up to the room. It's worse. It's just really stinking. So I got the people that are in charge of the house. I said, man, I don't know what it is, but something is just deadly. So, long story short, come to find out Ozzy had been staying there. And he'd been in that. That was his room.
Right.
I raised up the mattress, and there's all these dead fish there.
Oh.
Oh, my God. So I said, you know, just take the bed. There's no way.
No,
you can clean that.
That smell will last for months.
Bed. So they had to replace the bed.
Was that his idea of a joke for the
next
person?
Next time I saw it, you know, we got something to talk about, fella.
Yeah. Bit fishy. Sorry. I think people listening will want me to ask this, although I think we all know what the answer is already. Are you ever going to work with Roy again?
I would love to. I don't know what the chances of that are. I would. I'd love to.
I can't believe he's 70, you know?
I can't either.
And
this worries me.
I think, in what way?
I'm surprised that he made it this long.
Well, no, and we all are, because he was ill, seriously ill with that whole lung thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it seemed to me that every year was an extra bonus for some time. And the fact that he's now, you know, very healthy.
He's really good.
And fit, and 70 years old, and still performing.
I didn't think he'd make it to 40 or 50.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, his fingernails used to go blue.
Yeah. No, I remember that, and you can see it on some of the old photos of him playing on stage. It's really weird-looking fingers.
He's great, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if the opportunity presents itself, yeah, I'd love to, for sure. I mean, I would set everything I'm doing aside to come do that.
I mean, I think he's thinking about doing another recording, but I suspect, you know, it'll be a homegrown solo jobby, which is great, you know.
I mean, I'd love to do it. Maybe I can twist his arm.
Okay, well, you twist his arm. I'll help you later, yeah.
Yeah, you do that.
But no, I mean, the thing is, he's covered so many different styles. I mean, there's the classic sort of singer-songwriter acoustic guitar, but then there's that really great rock band time and a kind of proggy time with you and Spedding and everything else. And I think, you know, it's such a nice mix of styles, and I think it'd be nice if he got back to the more raucous side.
I think
just
if
one
he
more
did
time,
one,
you know?
One more like that that'd be perfect.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, it would. Oh, well, okay.
I mean, I love all the Roy stuff, but that's one of my favorite records, and not because I played on it. because it does, it rocks.
It does, and there's a lot of people that come to it, to his music fresh now.
Yeah.
And I always say to them, you know, if you want a rock thing, go for HQ. Yeah. That's the first one. If you want, you know, Dylan-y type stuff, go for the really early stuff, you know. Or if you want a kind of folky, rocky, less in-your-face stuff, go for some of the later stuff.
I mean, you got the real serious cricketer, and then you got grown-ups are just silly children.
Yeah, I love that.
It rocks, you know.
I love that.
I mean, it really fast.
There's a particularly manic version of that on the BBC thing, actually. Yeah, and I love that. It's better than the one on the record, I think.
I need to hear it.
Though. Yeah, yeah. We'll get that sorted.
Wonder if we have any help doing that. I don't know.
What are you saying, Dave?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't say anything.
All right, final question.
Okay.
Did we miss any anecdotes out last time? I think we talked about hotel shenanigans and, you know,
jumping off the roof.
Yeah, something like that.
We did that.
Yeah, we did that.
Los Angeles. We did
talk about that. Okay.
And the hookers.
Well, yeah.
That's why we moved hotels. It was a place where Tom Waits was staying, and we just went there and we thought, oh, this will be cool. And then I'm standing out on the, I didn't smoke then, I don't know what I'm doing out on my balcony, but I was out there and this like real good looking little young girl comes over. She, well, you know, I'll do something for you for $10. I said, what? She said, yeah. I said, hold on. Hey, Roy, we got to get out of here.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
This is not the right place to be. So we went to the hotel down in Beverly Hills, and right in the middle is like a kind of a courtyard. There's a big pool. And it's only three stories. I said, I think I can make that. So I run across the roof. Yeah! Splash. And Roy's going, okay, now here I go.
Did he do it as well?
Yeah.
Oh, right. I didn't know that. I thought it was just you.
No, we all
knew. No, you're mad.
Yeah, we are.
But you're still alive.
Yeah.
So. Okay, I think we're done. It's been so nice to catch up with you again.
Well, thank you for asking me again.
I think we might be heading off for a coffee and then maybe a beer, so.
Starbucks. No beer for me.
All right.
I'm off.
Under her size, as the flames of eternity rise. Two liquors with the firstborn lash of dawn. Oh, really, my dear, I can't see what we feel. We're sat here with ourselves and between us.
Was Another Day from the BBC Tapes, Volume 5. It's late November and it's a Wednesday evening, and I'm very, very delighted to introduce on the Roy Harper podcast, Mr. Roy Harper. How are you, Roy?
Thanks, Paul. I'm pretty well. I just had to move my location. I've just come back into the studio and I'm sitting down. Are you sitting comfortably? Yes, I am. Then you can begin.
That's good. Now, this podcast is going out in the aftermath of what I think is perhaps the best Roy Harper gig I've been to, the Royal Festival Hall on November the 5th, and I want to talk about that quite a bit. I've got sound bites from various people that from before the gig in the pub when we were all having a chat, and also some rather emotional people talking afterwards. But how did you feel it went?
Well, I thought it was top ten gigs, Roy Harper gigs, lifetime.
Mm.
So, you know, I don't have any qualms about that. There have been some other good gigs. But, you know, it's in that top notch of them.
Yeah. It was interesting because there were lots of grown men and women in tears during the concert, myself included, you know, doing the thing of clearing your throat that you do when you're embarrassed about being moved emotionally. But I felt that you everything fell into place, but more impressively, perhaps, in such a large venue, you made the whole place shrink and it felt very intimate again.
Actually, that's the way it felt for me as well. I suddenly was in a club somewhere.
Mm, yeah.
And because I could only see a small portion of the audience. In any case, it seemed to me like there was it seemed to me like the glow from the stage lit a certain, like, 200 or 300 people at the front. And that was it. And, you know, I was more or less sat singing for them. You know, it was like that. You know, it's the first time I've thought about that. But actually, that's what my memory... My mental vision, of, you know, my recall tells me that it was like. So, yes, I had no idea, really. I didn't think about it at all, not even when the lights went up at the end.
Mm.
You know, I didn't think about that, it being like a, you know, 2,500 people. It was nothing, there was no thought of that. But actually, what it does do for me at this point is to tell me that actually 2,500 people is intimate, if I can make it that way.
I think it's a particular skill that you've got as well with connecting with the audience, but I was so impressed that it came off, as we've just said, in such a large hall.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I just think it's the kind of thing that I aim for always, and I've always have done. Now and again, it comes off spectacularly, but and this that was one, you know, one occasion. You know, there are plenty of occasions when it doesn't, but actually a lot of those are in front of silly amounts of people. You know, afternoons at a giant festival isn't that good for someone like me, because you can see the thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and you know that you can't really do the things that you want to do, you know, that you normally can do at night in an enclosed atmosphere. So, you know, it is, I am more of, perhaps more of a one-on-one person as a performer than most people who perform in front of others.
Well, there's been some possibly unfair comments about Bob Dylan on the forums in the last few weeks, and people have been saying how disconnected he seems to be with his audience, and you get a feeling of him doing it, you know, by the numbers. I don't know whether that's fair or not, because I've never seen him.
Well, I think he's ducking the issue.
Right.
I get the impression, really, that, I mean, if he can sing the songs, why doesn't he actually give the occasional introduction?
Yeah.
Because doing it like that sort of lights off at the end of the song, and then, you know, totally, and then lights on again as soon as the next song starts, that isn't really what you came to see. That was, you know, I can make the joke now because it's actually come true, but, you know, in 1975 when, you know, I actually was 76, I think, when I was, Floyd and I were recording at Abbey Road, and I made the quip that, you know, you could make cardboard cutouts of the band and put them on stage and play the record and no one would know the difference.
Yeah.
You know, and Roger actually then at because we used to have, you know, our meals in the canteen at Abbey Road, and, you know, you'd gather at mealtime and, you know, you'd all be there. And in one of those moments of silence, Roger said, "Cardboard cutouts, eh?"
Right.
You know, but actually it came true because he then took that idea and you know, exactly. He started playing me a record about a year later of demos on a cassette player. And I was frantic to get to the, you know, to the snooker tournament that we were playing. And he was stopping in between shots to play me this weird stuff on a demo tape, you know, and then saying, and the next thing that happens is that we build a wall in front of the band, and then my ears pricked up. I thought I've heard this somewhere before.
Yeah.
You know, so actually, you can do that. It's a fact of life that, you know, you can actually, a stage is a place where you can build a wall in front of your audience. Mm. And, you know, there are many ways of doing that. Dylan seems to have chosen one which is, you know, particularly antisocial. But, you know, that's his choice. And, you know, perhaps he can say things like, well, I don't want to be the savior anymore, you know, the messiah. You know, but actually he was only that for a very brief period. You know, after that he was, you know, he was Bob again. And, you know, I think he's taken care that much because I don't think he needs to. I don't think I don't think he really sees it anymore as anything other than, you know, a job, really, which is what it is. And, you know, but I actually try to, I don't want to knock him because, you know, There were fantastic songs he wrote in that period, you know, Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands and Visions of Joanna and you know, Desolation Row. You know, those songs are brilliant. And it's just that, you know, what went before them isn't, and what came after them isn't as good as that.
Yeah, I think a lot.
So, you know, I think that you know, there's a lot of, it's down to this thing again of it's time and place. And, you know, if you were born in the USA in the 40s, somewhere in the 40s, you got into music at the right age, you had a huge constituency to get into, to grow into, to carry along with you. All of the baby boom period is there in your hands if you can mold them that way. And so that's a huge constituency, whatever. You know, it's close to all told 100 million people probably. Mm-hmm. And if you can't actually get, you know, 1% of them involved in what you're doing, because what you're doing is part of a huge social movement, then, you know, you're not having very much luck at all, or, you know, you're not pressing the right buttons. Now, you know, myself, I was working with 1/5 of that population, and I wasn't pressing the right buttons, you know, because I was always doing something that the majority of the population really found it very difficult to get into. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm writing longer things, and, you know, they're more intricate, and they're more demanding, and there isn't the sort of jingle with them. Mm. There isn't the 3-minute radio jingle. So, you know, I'm doing something completely different, and I've only got 1/5 of the constituency to draw on. And, you know, once you do hit that seam as a young man, like he did, a very young man, which is where most, you know, where most seams are hit to the most effective, to their most effective, you know, when you're sort of 20, 21, 22, then you drag most of the population with you, everybody who's got, you know, disposable income, who's that young, who doesn't have to pay the mortgage, you know. And, you know, as I've previously noted, the dance set revolution, which, you know, not only existed in the UK, but right across the USA as well, was the only form we had at the time of having a private radio station of our own. Mm. And, you know, that hit so many people, and so many people became stupidly rich because of it, including Bob. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they didn't really have much in the way of well, a lot of them, you can't generalize to that extent, but a lot of them didn't have the energy, really, you know, the creative energy to carry on much beyond their, you know, 40, 50 era, let's say. And, you know, why bother? You know, why bother? What are you doing? In the end, I think possibly you come back to it because as age begins to take its grip, then you resort to the kind of thing that, you know, you were doing early on because, you know, the yacht doesn't fulfill very much for you. You know, and how big can a house be?
Indeed.
You know, how many Persian carpets can you have in one room? You know, but yeah, so that, you know, that he has lost that creative energy, and it's, you know, I don't know whether you can knock him for that. I mean, you can ask questions perhaps, but, you know, if he doesn't want to communicate, then what does he do? He just turns off. If he's scared of it, if he's really frightened of it.
Now, I know you're in London for quite a few days before the gig, and it's made me start wondering exactly what's involved with putting on large concerts and ones with various guest artists and all that kind of stuff. I mean, practically speaking, how much effort does it take to put on a show like that?
Well, there's a huge amount of effort goes into it. There's a kind of a responsibility as well, which because we did it totally by ourselves. There was no promoter, there was no agent, you know, there was the only components were us and you know, Science Friction and the Festival Hall. And because I know the ropes sufficiently well, particularly with that hall, I was able to do it. But nevertheless, there were strains and stresses. And one of the major strain, and actually probably the major stress as well, is the vocal, because I was doing radio interviews up until the day before rehearsal. And they were pretty inclusive. I mean, they included everyone, I think. I mean, I don't think there was a sort of major station anywhere that I didn't talk to.
It was newspaper. Yeah.
Yes. Or newspaper, you know. So, and that went right up to the day before. And then, you know, there was the rehearsal, and I knew what I'd done was that I'd set myself up to have a free day on the 4th, because I knew that whatever rest there was to be had, I'd better take the day before. So none of the rehearsal was set for the day before. Nothing at all, just a rest day. And I managed to get away with it with just that rest day. Mm. But it was kind of touch and go. And I wondered at the start of the day whether I was going to make it. At half time, I knew that I was. You know, because I'd taken it a little bit easier than I would do as a kind of club gig end of the tour, where I could let everything hang out and go for it in an athletic sense. But I'd kind of held back a little bit, not that much, but just there were one or two notes. It's very strange. You know which notes are going to kill you. You know which notes they are, and you know that they don't really... If you can sing the same note with a different word in a different song, then it won't count. But a particular word in a particular song will take your vocal down to paper thin, you know, within seconds. And so I was laying off on the known culprits. And at the same time, I don't think anybody knew that. You know, for instance, I can do usually a whole lot more ad-lib stuff in North Country. You know, and it doesn't count for anything. It's just me sort of doing it because it's music. And that was pulled back. You know, so there are obvious candidates. And that was one of the reasons for doing Highway Blues first.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, you're cute. You just have to be cute with the set. Doing Highway Blues last, you know, of the first half is going to rip your throat out for the rest of the gig, probably, if you're not careful.
Interesting.
You know, so that's a stress that, you know, a strain more than a stress, that it results in a stress. So that's the number one. The number two is kind of the requirements on my time. You know, the people need this, they need that. Everything is needed to happen. It's in the right sequence. You know, so nobody else can direct it except me. Of course, it directs itself after a while. But actually, you know, being the virtual director of everything, your time is already tabulated. You know, so that's another one. And it's a big one too, because it involves, you know, it's 24/7 if you let it.
Mm.
And the third one, really, of the big ones is actually getting people there on time at the right time to coincide with events happening for them. You know, so getting Joanna from California,
mm-hmm.
With enough time to do some rehearsal. And that was the one thing I did on the 4th.
Oh, okay.
So the only thing I did on the 4th was to go across to the festival hall and go through a quick rehearsal with Joanna. And once we'd been through it three times, we knew that whatever we did, we couldn't impact any more on it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't going to change from what it was. So no matter how many times we rehearsed it, it wouldn't have mattered. So we went through it three times. The second time, I made the mistake of singing in the part that she was singing. Right, so that really takes it down to twice we went through it. So, but it was there, you know, to do. I had to do it. And getting Jimmy into the right place at the right time, you know, not bad at all, because he's very dependable when he's, you know, when Jimmy says he's going to do something, he's very dependable.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll leave that there. But getting people to, like Keith, getting Keith Moon to the Rainbow in 1974,
yeah,
was like half the energy I spent that day.
Right.
Yeah, we had to go round to his place and get him out of bed. That was the start. You know, we had to actually literally get him out of bed.
Oh dear.
When I was flagging towards the beginning of the gig, and as I'm starting flagging, you know, he opens his briefcase and he's fiddling around in there. Then he comes up, opens the palm of his hand, and he points at these pills in his hand. He says, "Right, you can take that now, put you in an upward direction." And he points at this black and red thing. And then he said, "And then you take these two, and they'll keep you going along nicely. And when you've had enough of that, take this one."
Dare I ask if you did?
No, I didn't.
No, probably very sensible.
I didn't. My throat was already shot. It was gone. That was the one night I needed to have a doctor who did the worst thing you could possibly do.
Mm.
It got me through the night, but it didn't do much for the next couple of months.
Oh, right.
It just about got me through the night. It was to shoot, a cocaine derivative down my throat to numb my vocal cords.
Oh, that's nasty.
You know, numb my the soreness.
Mm.
And of course, I ripped my throat out.
Yeah.
And it's actually that is getting people to the right place. Because if you've got an agent or a manager who can do that, then it's a responsibility taken from you. But I've always had to manage these situations myself, mm-hmm. because, you know, it's always, in my own case, been artist to artist rather than, you know, you can't expect a manager to go and manage somebody else's artist.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those, you know, incompatibles you never think about. So those are the main three things.
Mm.
But actually, once you've got those handled, once those are in hand, then, you know, you can expect a certain flow. And I think actually part and parcel of the reason that gig was so successful was that I got the right kind of help from the friends that I had around in terms of the guys who played.
Oh, right.
You know, to be there at the right time and do things in the right way. And, you know, and that includes the string players and everyone. That includes everyone you saw on the stage and everyone at the back of that. You know, everybody wanted that gig to happen. At the back, everyone at the back of that stage, all the women at the festival. I didn't talk to a man at the festival hall. Oh, I did. I talked to the sound guy once. But the women at the festival hall and, you know, myself and my help in terms of the, you know, the other people who played, all wanted that gig to happen in the way it did. And it did because of that.
You mentioned the orchestra, the strings and the brass, and it was very pointed when you talked about David Bedford and Bert Jansch as well. I mean, how did you manage to... I don't know quite how to ask this, but... How did you manage to get somebody sorted out and get them involved without David? And it can't have been very easy, because, I mean... He only passed.
It was incredibly difficult. It was difficult because on the Thursday, David was telling me that he had an infection.
Right.
And it had been bad, but they thought they had control of it now. So there was a chance that he could come out and he could be there, but he certainly wouldn't be able to be on stage.
Right.
On the Sunday, he was dead.
Mm.
So that's 3 days later, you know. 4 days later. And so, you know, it was a complete surprise for me and a shock.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, the hours after when after I'd taken it in, and I just thought, oh, God, what am I going to do? You know, the first thing you think is, oh, David's gone. I can't believe that. He's gone. I'll never see him again. What? You know, it's there's an unbelievable side to it, because you can't imagine that one of your friends who you treasure, you'll never see again. And you spoke to him on the Thursday, you know. And, you know, after the initial shock of that, I thought, what am I going to do? And I started asking questions around, and, you know, through everybody I knew. And a certain person who owns a record company says, I know a good person to have around in circumstances like this. So, you know, I said, okay, fire away. And he gave me number of a lady who really did come up trumps. But the big problem, a bigger problem than that, was actually finding David's scores, David's parts.
Oh, gosh.
Because there was no, his daughter couldn't find where they were. So she couldn't find them. She eventually found them after the concert. But I remembered that we'd taken some away from a gig way, way, way back, and that they were somewhere in the house. So we had a start on some of the songs. But Fiona, who helped us to do to get the parts together and who wrote some herself, worked hard on it. And in fact, she came over here to Ireland with the guy who conducted it, because she couldn't conduct it at the time, because she's making a record with someone in Houston, Texas. So she couldn't be there, which was a pain. So she brought the guy who was going to conduct it, Benjamin, over. And they both sat down with me, and we went through things. And, you know, I gave them my ideas. They gave me theirs. It was a really good exchange. We went out to Johnny's studio in Timberleague, Johnny Fitzgerald, and he, you know, it's state of the art out there. So, you know, Johnny had gracefully and graciously, and gracefully actually, allowed us to you know, occupy the building for the afternoon. And it was a really good place to be. And we got it sorted out. We got, you know, we went through all of the things that were on the agenda. And I played the guitar and they wrote things down. And we noted all the keys and, you know, everything else. And she went away and got the parts together. And then I turned up on the 2nd of November for rehearsals with them, and they were a brilliant crew to get to know. They were the best. Mm. Those people are kind of top draw people. Mm. And you know, we slowly managed to get into each other, and after a while, we discovered, you know, that we were kind of living mutual lives, that, you know, I wasn't talking any foreign language to them, and, you know, that we had exchanges that you can only dream about, really, with musicians, insofar as they wanted to know what the song was about,
right, yes,
what they should be feeling about them, and what, you know, the essence of them was, how they were written and stuff like that. And Tracy was telling me to get on with it. And, you know, and I'm actually, what they want is to know about the songs, which is kind of, which is really refreshing and really, really great. I went into the second day with them with a completely fresh attitude altogether. And we really enjoyed, I really enjoyed the rehearsal. And that was symptomatic of the gig, because it carried on. And at the end of the gig, they were all really congratulatory, you know. They were all so very friendly, and they were so pleased that it had worked.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they were so professional. They knew that, you know, because David was talking about hiring students from the Royal College of Music.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, as a cheaper way of going about things. But the way that these guys did it, it was so professional and so friendly and so, well, actually professional is friendly, you know, that I would miss them in future engagements like this if they weren't there, you know. We have a bond now together, you know, and it needed people who sat on that stage before and who know what, you know, being confronted with 2,500 people is like. You know, it took that. It takes that. That's what it's about. But it's about being in that position, not for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everybody enjoyed it immensely. It was a hugely successful occasion. And, you know, I thanked everybody afterwards profusely. And, you know, I felt a bit sort of anticlimactic at the end because...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I wanted to start again and do it all again. You know, you never want something like that to stop.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
You know, it brought me to tears a couple of times, but actually... They were tears of joy and sadness combined, which is where you get to with performance at its best. You know, because that's where you get to with writing. That's where you are during the time you're writing the song. In any case, you know that what invariably appears with me in it with a good inspiration is, as I've said before, is a tear. And a tear arrives at the beginning of a good inspiration, but the hard work then ensues towards getting the final tear, which happens when you've finally written the song and it comes out as good as the inspiration. You know, if it doesn't, invariably, I throw things away or change them. But, you know, a song is about emotion. It's about, you know, the expression of emotion, and if you can't get back to it, then you can't get back to it. And, you know, it's not really worth that much. But I was getting there on that night. I was getting there very frequently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it showed. Now you can put that on. If you're in a, you know, a band, an ensemble, you know, of a collective of a huge amount of people, or even, you know, four people in a band making a lot of noise, then you can get people's emotion there because of the hugeness of it, of the gigantic message that, you know, that's being passed to your senses. And the artists themselves can be doing it night after night and not really going through it anymore, but actually their audience are. And I've seen that. But, you know, on an occasion like that, I was completely open. My emotions were raw, and they were there to be seen and experienced by everybody, and everybody's emotions were there to be experienced by me and everybody else too. So it was a really successful night in that sort of a way. You know, after that, you kind of ask yourself, how can I do this again? How can I possibly do this again? You know, and you just have to shrug your shoulders, really, because it's, you know, it's one of those nights when everything is successful, works out really successfully, apart from the Guardian review, of course.
Well, yes.
But
some people just are never happy with, you know.
Well, I've come to the conclusion, right, as well as with a lot of other people, that Robin just doesn't get it.
Yeah, I agree.
He just doesn't get it. And actually, it's not worth having a go at him. He just doesn't get it. So if he doesn't get it, he shouldn't be there, really.
No, he's in the wrong
place. He shouldn't be there anymore. He should sort of take himself off and excuse himself on, you know, another occasion. But, you know, that aside, it was a hugely successful night. And, you know, I would like it to be so the next time, but you can't guarantee that.
A lot of people have been asking whether there's going to be a CD or anything. Have you got any plans for that, or is it too early to say?
Well, we did record it.
Right.
You know, these things tend to get shelved with me quite a lot, and it's not at the top of the list, I have to say.
Okay.
You know, the top of the list right now is getting the songs together for the next record.
Ah, well, there we go.
Which is, you know, now gone a bit further than pressing. So, you know, I'm going over to record in California in January, and which was an obvious time to leave this climate.
Absolutely.
You know, so I was kind of asking, them over in California, when's the best time for me to arrive? And they just said, well, now. So, you know, that's more or less what's happening.
Wow. That's news. I mean, it's been a long time.
Yes, it has been a long time, but there's been so much going on.
Oh, I know.
It's been, you know, it's been a hard job to actually collate everything that's happened in this last 10 years. You know, for one person, really. I say, you know, it's one person assisted by 1,000 women who shall be nameless. yeah. A woman's work is never done.
Oh, no, that's what they say, isn't it? Okay, so that's great to hear that there's more stuff coming. I mean, I wanted to just...
I don't want to cast any aspersions.
No, don't want to get into trouble.
Aspirations or...
The publicity machine, just going back to what you said about being on radio and interviews and everything else, I've never ever seen anything like it, you know, with you. And I think I told you on the night of the gig, such a surreal experience, sat at my kitchen table watching breakfast telly, drinking a cup of tea and having you on on BBC One.
Yes, it was remarkable, actually. But then, you see, I've got to such an age now that people are actually willing to give me a little bit of leeway because they realise that, you know, they realise that actually, you know, I survived for some reason or another without having that much of a robust health.
Yes.
I've managed to survive. And why? How is this? How can this be? And, you know, he must have something... There must be something rational going on somewhere, you know? There must be something that we don't know or that we didn't suspect or something. But, you know, people are willing to give you more time when you reach this kind of an age. And although I don't like being this kind of an age, there are the enjoyable bits, you know? Because obviously I still think of myself as 19, you know, which is...
we all do, don't we?
Yeah, until you look in a mirror, it's completely true. And when you do look in a mirror, it's a horrible lie. In fact, it's a lie. But yes, I think the publicity machine was very good because it was put into gear by Salvo, the label that put out the double.
Oh yeah.
Songs of Love and Loss. And their publicity machine is... The machinery they use is very, very good. And, of course, they have a lot to go on with me. It's not so they you know, they're plucking someone from obscurity and trying to build a story around them. You know, all you've got to do is wind me up for 5 minutes and... Not even that, you know, a minute, and, you know, and I'll go for a good hour. So, and, you know, I don't need to, you know, the subject will get changed whether you like it or not.
Yeah. I've noticed that.
So, you know, I'm a bit of a liability in front of the microphone, I think that their publicity machine is very good. It consists of a company called Impressive, you know, who themselves, Salvo and Impressive. And Salvo is part of Union Square. And so Union Square was paying for it. Nice. But, you know, the guys at Union Square are very, very good, very good at what they do. And, of course, they're the kind of people who would have at one time have been at a major record company.
Yeah.
But because all the record business has been marginalized so much, they now find themselves working in a place they love to work, you know, with music, but, you know, in more of a restricted atmosphere than they would be if they were with a major, and yet it's freer. You know, it's freer because they can do more of what they want. So, you know, at the same time as being a much smaller, and, you know, in terms of being restrictive, it is a much smaller industry now. But they are able to do the kind of things that majors can't do. And, of course, the whole thing now is in such a disparate mess, you know, the music business, that nobody knows who's who anymore. And so if you've got somebody coming through to you like me who's actually got an opinion or two or, you know, something to share with you or, you know, let's leave it at that, then, you know, and who's had a history of a few decades in music, then actually that's going to... You know, it's going to fill a lot of those places. It's going to be usable by a lot of those places that usually find it very, very difficult to get a hold of people like me, find it very difficult to get you know, a hold of people of my generation and perhaps standing, although, you know, you see, it's very difficult to actually compare me with my peers because, you know, a lot of my peers are dead. A lot have, you know, dysfunctional lives. Mm-hmm. A lot are very old in their minds.
Yeah.
And, you know, others are, you know, what does the average radio station do to contact Mick Jagger? They can't. Mm. You know, Sir Mick has come to the phone. You know, neither is Sir Cliff. And, you know, you can go on down that tree. You know, down that... the whole system and not find anybody to speak to. And actually, I guess, eventually speak to someone like me is at least a good substitute, a reasonable substitute anyway, for, you know, people they can't get hold of or people who just don't, are not willing to share what, you know, their to articulate their thoughts on air, you know. Mm. And so it's very difficult, and you know, again, for them, and so, you know, they get a hold of someone like me. It's kind of much better than average for them in some ways. They find it, obviously they find it frustrating because they're not really appealing straight away to that band in the population who have the most disposable income. You know, the young between, you know, 14 and 25, as it were. Mm. Although a lot of them are out of work, they still have disposable income. You know, judging by the amount of you know, smartphones you see in young people's hands, you know. So, you know, someone of my age isn't going to be able to get through to the people who have the real disposable income. But then there's people on the other end who have disposable income. You know, the over 60s will kind of have disposable income now. Mm-hmm. And so those who haven't been ripped off with their pensions.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, the people who've finally got rid of the kids and don't have as many, you know, financial responsibilities and that. But if you're in the middle, in that mid zone of being, you know, from 30 to 50, you're tied up now trying to make ends meet.
Yes.
And it's not, you know, it's very, very difficult for you. I know because I'm in there. I'm, you know, I'm living it. As an older person, I'm still involved in it.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Still involved in, you know, hand over fist, trying to earn a living, hand to mouth.
Mm. I mean, do you have any sense that you're reaching new ears, younger ears now? I'd have thought you probably would be.
Yes, I am. It's not as obvious in this country as it is in the USA.
Right, okay.
Because in the USA, there are a lot of young people following me in terms of artists. But that hasn't actually transferred yet wholly to this country. I think, you know, once you're dead, it helps. I don't want to get there too quickly, though.
No, don't do that.
That's what it takes to become famous. I'll hold on for a while.
Hmm.
You know, but you know, it's kind of it helps because then, you know, you don't have this. You don't have Johnny Cash coming on air and saying, "Well, I went down to Folsom Jail," you know, and played for the folks down there. You know, whatever, you know, and he's still living that kind of dream, and he's actually, you know, looks as though he's not very well and very, very old.
Although those last few albums that he did, the American recordings, are absolutely stunning. I don't know if you've heard any of them.
Yes, they are, yeah, I do him down. Yeah. But, yeah, and he is one who kept hold of the torch, that's right.
Mm.
Same as Willie Nelson. To a degree, but you know, being you don't want to get confused with, you don't want to confuse life with death, in that, you know, that people, young people like to be able to get something that's integral. They like to have a whole something. They like to have pictures of the people back in the day when they were really doing it.
Right.
You know, with what they might have worn and what they might have thought, what they might have played, what they might have done. You know, how it was like, what it was like. Without some ancient apparition coming in front of them and saying, well, you know, when, etc.
Yeah.
Because they don't need that. You know, you as a younger person, you don't need that. That's kind of almost like taking coals to Newcastle. And it's sort of a mad interruption, you know, by a senior citizen who should know better. You know, he should go away and have a senior moment elsewhere.
Okay, our time's pretty much up, and I'd like to thank you for expressing your thoughts so clearly, as always. Is there any last comment or message you'd want to pass on to the listeners?
Yeah, I wasn't that articulate tonight. That's one thing. The other thing is that, thank you all for your support. For your continued support, because it's actually making a difference, and it will do long term. Anyway, it's something irreplaceable, and you know, maybe the next podcast should be entirely about my thoughts on, you know, the younger people. Yeah.
Well, Roy Harper, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your evening. Speak to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. We'll speak soon. Thanks.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
See you in a bit, Paul. Bye.
Still the
Now, because it's December, we are doing our usual festive cock 50, which is an end of year voting where people get to write in and say their favourite top 5 or top 10 or whatever albums of the year, and they send them to Mr. James Hanley, who then collects all the information and basically tells us who's won and who's at the top of the list. And I usually find it gives a really good selection of albums I may have missed during the year that other Stormcock people, other Roy Harper fans are into. And I've discovered some real gems from that. So check out the off-topic forum on stormcock.net, or if you're already on the Stormcock mailing list, you'll already have had an email from James about this. The message will contain information about how to vote as well. And of course, once we've finished with that, I believe on the last day of the year or early next year, James will post the results. It's a lot of fun. Credits and copyright. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which means you can freely share it with others, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and isn't for copying or redistribution. And I think that's pretty much it. So thank you all for listening, and I'll speak to you again in 2012. Bye for now.
Button. You ready? There we go. Post-gig report. Who wants to start?
I told you Jimmy wouldn't show up. If he did, he'd be rubbish.
Who is that grey-haired man?
I don't know.
Oh, right. Okay.
Looked and sounded like. We're walking. Like a kind of.
Well, I didn't talk to Robin before. Hello, Robin.
Oh, hello there.
How was the gig?
It was pretty good for me. It's good to see people with grey hair on stage. Actually,
I agree entirely. Yeah.
I think we're two of them at a time.
And I think
brilliant.
More beards should be encouraged. Also.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm glad we're on the call.
Yeah.
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 Very good.
Perhaps Jimmy should grow a beard then.
I think he should.
Yeah. I think he should.
Yeah. It's too clean cut at the moment.
Yes.
Very good. Very good. And George, my old friend George. How did it go?
It's good for me.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's speechless.
Jokes. I was blown away.
We all got quite emotional, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And Roy's voice cracked, and then my, you know, I got something in it, and things went uphill from there,
yeah.
Really. And that's and that is an affected Roy Harper fan sobbing into the microphone.
That's how good it is. It's how you walk away.
I know. Yeah. Okay, they've all backed away now. Look, so I'll have to stop now.
Don't, baby, come here.
Big voice made me do it, and yeah, then they ran away. What have I got to say now?
How was it for you, darling?
It was quite emotional, really, and I was pleasantly surprised by how emotional it was for himself. I think it's so nice to see him come out and play, and actually not that he's kind of been a do it by numbers merchant, but.
He was very in the moment,
he
wasn't he?
Yeah, he really seemed to care about what was going on. And, you know, one of the most important things about him is the emotional response, really. Not just him, but us silly buggers that
Well, there was that whole synergy thing with the audience going on, which in a venue that size...
I'm not talking to you now, you've said synergy.
You're not.
No, I think, really, that's completely ridiculous. There's only so much cider a man can take.
Alice.
Oh, dear. Okay. And Alice, how was it for you?
It was a big one. It was a good
was
one.
Was it?
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. And it was great to see Jimmy, because it's the first time I've seen Jimmy play with Roy.
Same here. I missed all the 1984 stuff.
Yeah, so that was tremendous. Yeah. I just wish it could have gone on for another hour, I think.
I'd go along with that. It stopped too soon. It seemed like we'd only just sat down.
Oh, well, you know, when you're used to the sort of, what was it, two and a half hour sets he used to do.
Yeah.
Sort of, I have to admit, I miss the small clubs. I mean, it's wonderful sound. It's a fabulous hall. But I miss the small clubs.
You're missing the Half Moon in Putney, aren't you?
The Half Moon in Putney and the Bloomsbury Theatre.
Oh, well, that's not a club. That's a theatre.
Yeah, but the Bloomsbury
mini theatre.
Wonderful. Really enjoyed it.
Oh, and we have a likely lad here in a purple T-shirt,
rocking
DJ Burnham, I believe, from the Ad Astral podcast.
Hello.
how was it for you?
It's going to take me a while to digest it, I think. It was wonderful. Absolutely super. I mean, ballsy start, wasn't it? Straight in with Hardaway Blues.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought, ooh, you know? Where's he going
and
with that?
That was really circular, because I mean, that's where I came in with that Stonehenge video. So that was, course, I think that's the first track on the video,
wasn't
it? Yeah. So that was wonderful. But, yeah. I mean, yeah, Jimmy, blimey. I never thought I'd see the day.
No, I didn't
just,
either.
I just sent Simon a text.
Oh,
Simon
really?
Taylor writing, because he saw him in Cambridge in about, I don't know, 1980.
Yes, he did, I know he did. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what he's like, he's even got a double neck guitar, for goodness sake. Yeah,
well, yes, but, you know, Spinal Tap moment.
Absolutely. But no, it was wonderful, wonderful. I mean, yeah, kind of emotional feedback as well, generally. Yeah. I mean, just, gosh, yeah, tingling. I mean, I cried a little bit during North Country, I don't mind admitting. Couldn't help myself.
Yeah.
It was gorgeous.
No, I'll See You Again got to me as well, because it just all sort of, you know, wrenched
it. It was a perfectly chosen set, wasn't it? Absolutely brilliant. I mean, really, you know. Okay, so I still want him to get on to 6 o'clock in the morning, but if you're going to have to.
You can't
say,
have everything.
You know, no, exactly.
Yeah.
But no, it's wonderful. And Joanna as well, my
goodness.
Because we saw her at the end of the road in the summer on the Sunday evening, and she was on the headline in the Sunday night, and she must have had, I don't know, maybe 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people. And just dead hush when she was playing. Apart from, I mean, you know, she's quite sort of like mellow generally. There was these three guys in the front really like giving it some, doing some full on like raving. Did you hear something? My God, they've had a weekend of that. But yeah, no, fantastic, no, wonderful, absolutely brilliant. Lovely. And by the sounds of it, possibly not the last.
Possibly not the last.
So fingers crossed.
That's something to think about. I'm going to end this batch with talking to my wife. I want to know what you made of the evening.
I come along with you.
Right.
Half a soup is very nice.
That's it. Thank you very much. That's a wrap.
So if he does another one, I think I'll bring my kids.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
You're so old. Come on, let's go and find a pub.